This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 407 of the Outlander podcast. I am Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Rebecca. So welcome back to the Outlander podcast. A very interesting person whom I cannot wait to talk to and share more information about his most recent work. Welcome, Dr. Michael Newton.
Tapalat. Thank you. Smalumavion. It's good to be here.
And I will allow him, dear listener, to do all of that. Because if I try any any Gaelic, I will butcher. So I will allow him. He's our Gaelic expert. Not me. Not us. Let me ask you, do you prefer to be referred to as Dr. Newton or is Michael okay?
Oh, you can call me Michael. That's fine.
Okay. Okay, perfect. So what we're here today, dear listener, to talk to Michael about is his latest work called Into the Fairy Hill. And that is, I think you will find it very interesting. And anyone who's a fan of Outlander or the world of Outlander, the universe of Outlander, will very likely have a natural interest in this subject matter because it is absolutely at home in the world of Outlander, insofar as the setting of the Gael. And it is fascinating, everything he's been able to put together. So let's start with, what made you even want to tackle this type of work?
Well, there are really so many different aspects of the Scottish Highland world, of Scottish Gaelic, you know, cosmology, history, culture, tradition, that have not been properly treated. So there's so much work to do. But in particular, this particular thing, so I teach online, and I've been slowly kind of building up the courses I have available. And about a year and a half ago, I think, I decided that I wanted to add a course about Highland folktales. But there's really, in my opinion, no really good general reader available. So I decided that I should try to put one together. And I've already taught a course at University of St. Francis Xavier in Nova Scotia, like about 10 years ago or something. And at that time, you know, same kind of issue reared its head, that there are some books you can use, but no really good general book that gives you some of the best versions of the tales that were collected and a general guide and overview of understanding the folktale tradition. Now, just coincidentally, it's not something that I planned at the time, but 2022, this year, has been designated by the Scottish government as the Year of Scotland Stories. So there's actually a lot of different events going on this year in Scotland to highlight the fact that Scotland has this very rich storytelling tradition and many different aspects of narrative that are woven into the culture and the history of Scotland. So that's just kind of a happy chance. I didn't plan that, but you know, sometimes things turn out that way. So when I was working on this, I had some previous work that I've done before that I was able to draw upon and also experience teaching. In the spring of this year, so about 6 months ago or something, I taught that folktale course for the first time online. That enabled me to think a little bit more about, you know, how to teach it and how to introduce it and to contextualize it. But in the course that I teach online, I'm using almost all this, only like two or three stories that I teach, that I have as part of the curriculum online or in the book. For the most part, there are two different sets of stories, but a very similar approach to teaching how to understand the stories. It's often the case that while I think there's a great deal of popular interest in the idea of the Highlands, but people have, you know, a lot of kind of misperceptions and misrepresentations in their mind because of the way in which Gaelic culture and history and tradition has been misrepresented in popular Anglophone discourse. And so there's just so much to do, I think, to kind of counter those misrepresentations and to provide people with access to actual reliable materials.
That's exactly what I came away with after reading it, after going through it. That is exactly what I felt this was.
Well, that's good. That's mission accomplished then.
I could see from the introduction exactly, you laid it out so nicely and so plainly what you wanted to do. I really appreciated with each of the five classifications or the five types of the fairy tales that you shared. I really appreciated that you shared the names, shared the origins or intros or descriptions or definitions of why these types of tales are called these things. And then, of course, the examples that you gave for each type. Again, I can't think, or I couldn't think before of the perfect term, but I think primer, I honestly, that was the word I gelled with that as soon as I heard you say that.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I think that one of the, I see myself as somebody who is trying to translate all of the really good academic and scholarly research that's been done that people who are highly trained know about into a format that people who are just the general public who have a general interest can access, because, you know, those of us who have academic backgrounds, like we know about a lot of these materials, but there's just a real gap between what those of us who go through years and years of reading and research, you know, have access to and the things that just like regular folk have access to. And so it's no wonder that people have all of these misrepresentations and misconceptions because they just don't have easy access to the real materials and the ways that have been developed to thinking about them and how to approach them and what they mean and so on. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do in the book. That's one thing. Actually, another thing is just simply that there are really great tales that were collected in the 19th century in particular, but they haven't been updated lately. And so what is generally available to people are in the Gaelic forms, they're not up to date. They haven't been regularized and standardized. And then the translations into English, many of them are very old-fashioned. They're very hard to understand, and quite often there are errors in them. So I've tried to clean them up and provide new translations and to fix these problems. And occasionally, there's also texts that have never been translated because they're a bit racy. And in the 19th century, it was really ministers who were in charge of editing texts and publishing texts. And many of them did not want this really racy stuff to get out there.
Would you say that there are plans or hope to have some of the
body or sexualized? Yeah.
Are there plans for that to be translated?
Well, some of the tales that I have in the book are of that nature. And there, you know, there's a good number of scholars in Scotland that are doing work on various texts, including folk tales that were transcribed in the 19th century. So some of that work is ongoing, but this is the book, Into the Fairy Hill. Well, the subtitle is Classic Folk Tales of the Scottish Highlands, because I wanted to give kind of a general overview and a sample of some of the best texts. But, you know, there's a lot of texts that have not been edited and translated and a lot of potential possibility for doing that. But, of course, you know, there's a fairly small number of scholars that are trained and really nobody working in the North American Academy on these things. So, you know, so it's a very slow process. Unless for some reason people finally figure out this is worth supporting in the academy in North America, it's just always going to be slow and at a distance.
Can you discuss briefly why the title and why the main title includes that term, Fairy Hill?
Sure. Well, this is a sort of homage to my mentor, my late mentor in Scotland, John McInnes, Ian MacInneish. And in one of the papers, one of the essays that he wrote, he talked about how in Gaelic cosmology, The Fairy Hill, well, it's many different things, but amongst the things that it is or can represent is a notion of the unconscious and the source of human creativity. So in many of the stories, you have the notion that people go, when they go into the Fairy Hill, they are very kind of captured by the creativity there, the music and the dance and the artistry, and time seems to stand still. So there are certain aspects of notions of the Fairy Hill and notions of the fairies, which seem to represent this kind of altered state of consciousness that happens when we are engaged in creative and artistic processes, whether this be storytelling or visual arts or music or dance or so on. So I thought that that would be, you know, a really good image and symbol to capture in the title of the book and to give it, you know, something kind of interesting and intriguing. I've written actually a very long article about this topic, about creativity and the way in which the fairies in Gallic tradition are very similar to the muses in Greek tradition, for example. Or, you know, in the Middle Ages, Christians believed that God was the source of all creativity, that we are merely vessels for God. And it's only fairly recently, in the last century and a half, that people have believed that individual humans can invent things and create things out of nothing that didn't exist before. That's a very, very recent idea. In the past, the idea was that we are the vessels of the divine and we can receive things from the divine. And in Gallic tradition, those divine sources, those kind of superior sources of wisdom and authority and so on, are the fairies. And I actually show this in a few of the stories in the book in the last chapter, which focuses on stories of the other world and otherworldly beings.
At the end, I would love if you would share, if it's available, a link to that article.
Sure. Yeah, I've got it on my academia.edu website. It's actually an article that I wrote that was published in the Harvard Proceedings of the Celtic Colloquium, you know, back like 20 years ago or something. So anyway, I mean, it's a good example of the ways in which the way that the fairy realm and the fairy beings are understood in Gallic tradition completely different from the way that people think about them in modern times in the Anglophone world. I mean, first of all, fairies are not little winged creatures in the Gallic world. They look like people. They look virtually identical to us, same, you know, size, same shape and everything else. But they have these really important roles as intermediaries between the human realm and the other world. And it wasn't just something that the poor peasants believed in. This was an aspect of Gallic cosmology, Gallic mentality that spanned classes and everything else. You could say this was a kind of one of the unifying aspects of Gallic tradition. And in fact, the professional classes of Gallic society legitimated themselves by their connections to the fairies, their connection to the other world realm was part of how they projected their kind of mystical sources of knowledge, their mystical sources of creativity, and maintaining that right relation with the other world realm was what legitimated kings or also brought about their fall.
You said there were still a lot, many, many manuscripts left that had yet to be translated just due to time, the number of historians or academics who can do it or who are interested or, as you said, who are supported to do so. How many would you say, if you had to guess, just how many untranslated manuscripts or tales are we potentially talking about?
Oh, quite a few. I recently saw, I was in the process of writing this book, an article by somebody who, some scholar sometime the last few decades, who said something like, and I don't remember which particular collection he was talking about, but there are many collections, that, you know, there's enough to keep a dozen scholars busy for 20 years, you know, so there's,
oh, wow.
There's a lot to do. I mean, some has been done since the time that he said that, but we also have now more sources than we used to. So, you know, there's a massive amount of material, and It's just, to me, a bit ridiculous when you look around at English departments in American universities and like you have one person in the department who's a specialist on Jane Austen and somebody else is a specialist on Dickens. They're so narrow. They're so niche. Why are we overrepresenting English tradition when we have so many other traditions that are part of our heritage, that are part of our background? You know, why don't you reduce the number of English scholars by half and make them specialists in the 18th century and then give some of those resources to people who do other things? You know, this is one of my pet peeves, obviously.
Yeah, I can absolutely see that taking away from a lot of opportunity.
Well, the thing about this, like one perspective, is that what happens in academia has always been a political exercise in creating, you know, a kind of unified front for what we think is important. But it's not representative of the people, of the heritage of the people who exist. So how the funds that were invested in academic disciplines and fields were allocated according to the actual background of the people who paid their taxes, it would be extremely different. And what happened, now it's better now than it used to be because we have ideals such as things like equity and diversity and things like that that didn't exist like in the 19th century, even the early 20th century, when you had, you know, again, a very diverse set of people in the States. But what academia was built to do was to create a facade for, you know, creating an assimilationist project of celebrating and lionizing Anglo-British heritage and making everybody assimilate to those norms. Now, supposedly, we don't believe that anymore, but still, the effects of that really haven't been taken on by the university. And there's a lot of ideals about decolonization, but it often lacks a linguistic and cultural component. It's very much more oriented toward gender, sexual orientation, and racial ideals, ideas about racial identities, which is not the same as culture and language. But anyway, I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole. The reason why this is significant is that there's a huge number of people in North America and the U.S. who have, you know, Gaelic-speaking ancestry, and yet they cannot learn about this thing anywhere, you know, and which is why I started teaching online, because I know that there are people that are interested who never had the opportunity, like me, when I had to go to Scotland to get a PhD because I didn't have the option of learning it here in the U.S., which is ridiculous, you know? Mm. So there are people who do want to connect to what their ancestral heritage was and to have, you know, a better understanding of it. And sometimes these people start with things like Outlander and they want to find, you know, the real material, the real history, the real literature. And so, unfortunately, there are very, very few, almost no opportunities to take such classes in the U.S. Yeah, because the U.S., since its inception, has idealized the idea of Anglo-Saxon, you know, dominance, right? And people nowadays are very aware of that, but they only think about it in racialized terms. They still haven't come to grips with the fact that when they celebrate British literature, that there are many languages in Britain, and it's not just literature written in English, for example. I mean, I occasionally do guest lectures and classes that are doing these surveys of so-called British literature that are completely silent about, you know, Welsh and Gaelic and other languages that exist in that realm of, you know, Britain. And yet still to this day, these kind of 19th century racialized views that, you know, celebrate the triumph of the Anglo-Saxons, they are invisibly there. They're silently there, and they upstage and they silence the opportunity to celebrate and recognize the literature of Celtic peoples.
Mm, yeah, I can see what you mean as far as the awareness culturally. You know, you see it in film, in TV now, you see it in social media. It's an awakening, a continued awakening, and you see that public awareness of DEI, of its importance in the workplace, its importance in all these different fields. But I can absolutely see what you're saying as far as you don't see, I haven't seen it. I haven't probably looked or noticed it obviously as much as you, because that is your field, but I can absolutely see what you're saying with regard to not seeing the same. I don't know if respect is the word. It may be, but purposefully or not purposefully, I can absolutely see its absence in those fields of literature, linguistics, etc.
Yeah, and these things they're so baked into the field of English and the way that, you know, historians approach British history and all these things that people aren't even conscious about it. And because they are things that are non-material, you can't like point at a Gaelic person and say, look, he's not being represented, because race is a different dimension than language and culture, right? So
absolutely,
it's a silent occlusion. It's a silent silencing. It's a silent triumphalism. And it takes a great deal of deconstruction for people to understand and see how that's been done.
How did you decide to come to which tales to include or not include? And how did you decide to, I guess, the sequencing of the five different fairy tale types that you identified?
Well, I did rely a lot upon my previous experience teaching folk tales when I was teaching in Nova Scotia. So I kind of had something to start with. I had kind of a basic introduction that I started working on from that seed that I'd written for like a custom course book that I did. And I had, a handful of stories probably that I had translated into English. And I don't think I had any, the Gaelic edition at that point. And then also, I guess about 3 or 4 years ago, I worked on a very large anthology, the very first comprehensive anthology of Scottish Gaelic literature with my friend Wilson MacLeod of Edinburgh University. So I had 2 or 3 texts from that project that were only excerpted in that book. And I wanted to use the entire material because they're very interesting and best appreciated in their full forms. So I had that, but I was also, I was familiar with stories that I thought would be worth trying to edit and translate. And I just started going back over all the materials that I have and tried to review other things that had, references in the bibliography to things that I hadn't looked at before. And so basically from the top view, I'm trying to give, again, kind of a general overview of what kinds of tales are there in Scottish Gaelic oral tradition, the folktale tradition. And of those genres, of those forms of tales, what are some of the best examples of those? So there's kind of that way of looking at it. And then another thing I wanted to do was represent the geographical diversity, because over the last century and a half, Gaelic has been pushed out of the Highlands by English and by the various forces of the Anglophone world. And as a result, Gaelic has maintained itself or been maintained the best in the Western Isles. So you get, the fullest and most expressive forms of many tales from the islands, the Outer Hebrides, especially, in the last century. However, even places as far east as Highland Perthshire and Badenoch and Invernessshire, places like that, had a wonderful tale tradition, but they tend not to be represented because they disappeared quicker because the language was pushed out quicker. And so what I also wanted to do was select tales from all over the Highlands so that people can see just how widespread the tale tradition was and how much these particular variants and the motifs and the genres are a unity. They're fairly uniform across the Highlands. So you get, you might get specific variants and certain motifs that are unique to certain places, but as a whole, they're part of the same storytelling tradition. And in fact, this storytelling tradition that unites the Highlands also unites it with Gaelic Ireland. So, and what's interesting and important about this is it helps to demonstrate that the Gaelic world across the Highlands and Ireland were very much connected and part of the same cultural zone and very different from the Scottish lowlands, which was connected via language to England. So you have a very sharp divide, not only in geography, but also in language and in literary tradition and in culture. That Highland-Lowland divide was a very, very important one. A very basic error that people make all the time is they assume that, you know, a country equals an ethnic group, and therefore Scotland is a single people, a single ethnic identity, a single tradition. That's just not the case at all. In Scotland, the Highland tradition, the Gaelic tradition, is united with Gaelic Ireland, and it's very different from the Lowland tradition.
While there was that unity across the Gaelic-speaking world, or you can see some of that unity in the similarities between the tales, there's also, and this is, you just said you wanted to show a wide variety of tales from all over the Highlands, as well as from the islands. And was part of that reason not just to show the similarity, but also show that sometimes or many times the geography of an area would explain maybe a difference in a theme, a difference in a name, in the way a tale was tweaked, quote unquote, if you will.
Right. So I'll just maybe generalize what you're asking to say. How does location play into the folktale tradition? And so what's interesting is that it kind of depends on the genre. So the genre that's kind of very tied to the professional literary tradition are the tales of the Fianna, you know, Finn McCool, and of the Red Branch, the Ulster heroes such as Cuchulainn. And in those cases, you know, these are fairly uniform texts that were recited and performed all across the Gaelic-speaking world in Ireland and in the Highlands of Scotland. When I say Highlands, that's inclusive of the islands. It's referring to the Gaelic world. So while on the one hand, the stories are fairly similar, but sometimes they're localized in particular places. So if you have a story about somebody like Giadamach, the hero who ran away with Finn's wife, you know, and battles the boar, there are many different places in the Highlands where his grave is said to be, and in Ireland as well. So the story can be localized in a particular place by tying episodes in the story to particular places that get named after the events in the story. However, the story itself is generally the same. So there's an interesting way in which the stories become localized by tying them to the landscape in that kind of genre. On the other hand, another genre of stories are what John McInnes calls clan sagas. So clan sagas are about particular warriors or heroes that come from particular clans, or these kind of ongoing stories about how particular clans may be at feud with another clan. And in this case, the stories are very localized because they're telling the point of view of a particular family or a particular, you know, set of leaders of that clan. And the other clan that they may have had a battle with will have a totally different version of that story. And there's a good example, a couple of examples in the book where I have a story about a particular battle. What is it? Strona Chlachang, I think it is, that was fought between McDonald's and Campbell's. And the stories that I have are from the Campbell point of view, but I make a reference in the book to how that story is told from a McDonald point of view. So the clan sagas are very localized kinds of stories, tales that give you the perspective of the people who are telling the stories, who are often related to the people involved in the stories. Now, on the other hand, the stories of, you know, Otherworld, again, there are very many similar stories with the same basic plots, but they can be set at different places. So you have a story which in Gaelic is referred to as Athi na Hanoichia, which means the one night shealing story. And this is a story that takes place at the shealings that people went to during the summer, especially the women and the children went to the shealings. But when it's not summertime, the men might use them as overnight places to stay, where they might go hunting during the day and then stay there at night. And there are many different places that have that name, and the story is told of those places in many different parts of the Highlands, but it's basically the same story. So again, these stories are kind of this very similar plots and very similar scenarios, but they get relocalized and told about specific places in the Highlands. So that's one way in which you can see how very similar stories get reshaped according to the local geography and the local power structures, the local, you know, political situations, basically.
Switching gears for a moment, if you're 50 or older, you won't want to miss this. Did you know that Gerber Life Guaranteed Life Insurance provides valuable whole life insurance protection to help cover your final expenses? It's true. And it can help with expenses such as medical bills, burial costs, and unpaid debts. It helps protect your family from the financial burden of your final expenses.
If you're between 50 and 80 years old, or 50 to 75 in New York, your coverage is guaranteed with this policy regardless of your health history. There are no medical exams to complete or lengthy health questionnaires to fill out. Simply visit GerberLifeFamily.com.
And premiums don't increase over time. The amount you pay when coverage begins is the same amount you'll pay throughout the duration of your policy.
Just answer four easy questions to get your free personalized quote instantly by visiting GerberLifeFamily.com.
See website for terms and restrictions.
If you had a guess, if you could even guess, that these stories began to diverge, when they began to slightly change before, you know, developing into what we have today in the remnants of, or the literature, the transcriptions of what was captured, you know, a century and a half ago.
So yeah, this is a really complicated story and question. And it's the kind of question that folklorists have been asking for the last 200 years. When they first noticed, you know, when they first noticed that, for example, the Grimms wrote down stories that were really similar to stories that were being told, you know, in the Highlands. And they were similar to stories that were being told in China. You know, people started comparing these texts and saying, oh, wow, this is basically the same story. But, you know, instead of, you know, this one character, it's renamed to something else, you know. So it depends on the story. The very first chapter of stories in the book are what are called wonder tales or international wonder tales, because the basic plots you can find in many, many different parts of the world, from China, you know, throughout Eurasia, into India, all kinds of places. So there are certain plots that were obviously so popular that they got relocalized. And then when you have people just telling these stories by word of mouth in their local communities, then they can really start to diverge. So, for example, you know, Snow White and Cinderella are two good examples of these plots that you can find all across the world, practically. And those stories, people believe that these can be many thousands of years old. And there's a lot of debate and speculation about how many thousands of years, but certainly, you know, several thousands of years. And then, of course, they get retold in forms that can spread through media. So once you start getting printed books, the authority of the printed word then makes a certain version of it more authoritative. And then you get Disney making films, and that has an impact on people's perceptions about the story and so on. But many of these wonder tales have been told in many different places for a very long time. Well, then you get particular versions that become coherent in certain cultural zones. So this is called an ecotype. And so what we see is during especially probably the Middle Ages, that certain versions of certain stories were fairly cohesive and coherent and stable in the Gaelic-speaking world of Ireland and the Highlands. And so there are certain stories where you can find these variants in those places, but they're different from the variants that were told in the English-speaking world, whether that be in the Scottish Lowlands or in England or, well, yeah, that in those parts, or places where those people went, such as North America or as colonists in Ireland or whatever. So what that tells us is that, you know, the Gaelic speaking world was a zone where people were highly networked, where they were telling the same stories, that they had the same kind of tastes in storytelling. They had the same cultural expectations and values and so on. So again, this tells us a lot about the distinction between the English speaking world and the Gaelic speaking world, whether that be in Scotland or in Ireland or anywhere else.
In your intro, you write, quote, "It is commonly claimed that until recently, Scottish Highlanders had nothing but oral folktales because they were illiterate and had no forms of written literature. But this is a misinformed fallacy. Written Gaelic literature has a venerable pedigree. The literary tradition shared by Scotland and Ireland is the oldest in Western Europe," unquote. So I thought that was very glad to read it. And some people maybe who haven't learned much about this topic or read much about this topic may be surprised at what you have written there. And so I want to ask on their behalf, how was this fallacy formed? How was it formed? Why did it form? And then how was it furthered or proliferated?
Well, again, when we're talking about English literature, we're talking about the literature of a people who were a dominant imperial power and colonizing power over the last several centuries. And when that happens, you know, when people have empires, they don't just exercise their political and economic dominance. They always create stories about why they're superior than other people. And that almost always involves saying that we are morally and culturally superior than those barbarians around us. That's just the way the empires work. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about the English or the Romans or the Chinese or the Russians or anybody else. That's just the way that people work. And so even though the fact is, for example, that Gaels were very involved in the creation of literacy amongst the Anglo-Saxons in the north, Northumbria. And, you know, they taught the Anglo-Saxons how to read and write, and they were involved in the creation of their literature. And there's some very new scholarship about this topic. So I'm not just making this up, but it's not very well known. And why is it not well known? Well, although that is the fact, these various, you know, institutions of learning, again, they're not just like, oh, let's just learn about stuff in the world because it's interesting. No, it's more like, okay, this is the way that we want our society to operate. These are the norms. These are the standards that we want people to accept and, you know, assimilate to and to aspire to. And that has been Anglophone and Anglo-dominant and Anglo-centric for several hundred years. And so therefore, that has meant the exclusion of other alternative languages and literatures and cultures. Now, the big players, the other empires like the French and the Germans and so on, tend to be included because they did the same thing. They had universities that had the same mission. And so because they're big, powerful groups, they tend to be better represented. And the smaller groups have been just smothered and choked off. And I mentioned this in the book. I don't go into depth about it, but a good example of this is what happened in the 18th century when a young Highlander named James McPherson published some poetry that he said were his translations into English of the Gaelic poet Ossian, who, according to Gaelic tradition, lived in the third century AD. Now, these stories and songs attributed to Ossian, in fact, there's a few in this book, these were things that everybody knew in the Highlands in Gaelic tradition, whether they be in Scotland or Scottish Highlands or in Ireland. They're very popular forms of folk tales and folk songs. But what James McPherson did was he adapted them in a very creative way that would appeal to an English-speaking audience. And so therefore, it was different from how it is in Gaelic tradition, but they became extremely popular, so much so that people like Thomas Jefferson were very excited. Napoleon was very excited about this. They had copies that they carried around and they read, and they had artists make huge, you know, artistic renderings of scenes and so on. So Ossian was a major literary success story in the late 18th century and early 19th century that actually sparked off the Romantic movement. So it was hugely popular, and Anglophones, whether they be in the Scottish Lowlands or in England, were very jealous of this. They didn't like this. And they wanted to see, is James McPherson telling the truth? Are there manuscript copies that we can find to prove that he's right? Or is there nothing? Therefore, he must be wrong. And the great English critic Samuel Johnson went to the Highlands. That he was, you know, again, he was not a Gaelic speaker. He had no background in understanding Gaelic tradition or literature, and he deemed it all a big hoax. And of course, he's such a big, important, authoritative figure that after writing that, most English people, most English scholars and critics have just continued to propagate that idea that, you know, James McPherson is a hoax. The Gaels are a barbaric people who have nothing sophisticated to say in their language. They don't have a literary tradition, and so on. So he is, you know, again, such a big authority, and he's so influential in the creation of the notion of British literature that this idea is continually repeated to the present day, even though we know it's not true, that the Gaels are this primitive, backward people who don't have a literary tradition, you know, who they're just a bunch of fakes and phonies. And they're big talkers, and they have amusing stories, but they don't have a literary tradition. And that's kind of the view that you still get amongst many people. Even if they're trained PhDs in English literature, they'll know nothing about the earlier influences of Gaelic and Celtic literatures upon English tradition, and the ways in which these traditions have been interacting for centuries, and that Gaelic has its own independent, highly sophisticated literary tradition. And the McPherson was not a fake and a phony. He was just adapting what he got through oral tradition in a very creative way.
I want to say that's shocking, but I don't think I can. I can't say it, but I don't think it's really truly, I have to second question myself, is that really that shocking? You know, knowing or given what we've discussed thus far, is it shocking that, number one, people would try and misprove him, or that he wouldn't be believed? And I think the answer has to be.
Well, it's kind of the plight of marginalized people, is that their stories get told by other people. And these other people are the dominant group who have automatic authority and automatic, you know, legitimacy. And the marginalized groups just continue to have their voices, you know, upstaged, you know, overrun by the dominant group, you know, whether that be through Anglo-splaining or, you know, whatever. And so that's certainly another of the goals of the book, is to let people have access so they can hear or read and understand the stories that Gaels told, you know, to each other and still to a certain degree to the present day, as part of their shared understanding of their culture, the shared understanding of their identity, their shared understanding of their history, because you don't generally find this stuff. And when I'm talking about, you know, Gaelic stories and Gaelic literary tradition and Gaelic folktales, I don't mean a story written by an Anglo that has Gaelic characters that they're choosing and adapting for an Anglophone audience. I mean the stories from Gaelic tradition, from a Gaelic point of view, for Gaels, amongst Gaels, you know, of Gaels. So it's a very different, you know, background. And so, you know, I think I've only watched the Outlander, you know, television series. I know many people that have read the books. I just don't have time to do large reading projects. But I would hope that people who find the idea of a Gaelic background, Gaelic historical background in the books and everything that's happening, they would be interested in finding out, well, what stories did the Gaels tell themselves about themselves? And how does this compare to Anglophone depictions of them in various, you know, novels or whatever?
When you mentioned, I forget the gentleman's name. I think it was a J name, but he was attributing his writings in English for an Anglophone audience of the bard, of the poet Ossian.
James McPherson.
James, yes. Okay, James McPherson. When you describe that, and when I remember that, it reminded me of one of the tales in chapter one, Tales of Wonder, I think it was the grazing of the Kruachen, not the whole thing. But throughout, I got this, and this, when you said James McPherson was doing this, is there a similarity between how they were told in Gaelic versus how some tales may have been told in biblical times?
Well, I think what you're picking up on is the influence of orality. So when you are hearing a story, and you have to remember it, and then you have to recall it and recite it, and you have to tell it in such a way that people that are listening are able to comprehend it in real time. It's different than when you are writing a story that is written down on a piece of paper that people can read at their leisure and review and come back to and reread and read slowly and skim over. It's a very different kind of style that emerges out of orality. And even though the Bible is important as one of the early forms of writing down stories, it came out of an oral tradition. So at some point, these stories that are in the Bible that are written down in this standardized form, at one point the stories came from oral tradition. And they were transcribed, and then they were edited and revised by people. But you still get echoes of the ways in which people told stories orally. And then, very likely also, you have the influence of knowing that these stories would have been, from even the printed Bible, until fairly recently, would have been performed orally. Because until recently, many people in the Christian world were not literate. So they needed the ability to comprehend the stories orally when the minister or whoever was, in the group that they were in was reading the Bible or stories from various books that we now call the Bible in such a way that they could comprehend it easily. And, how did Jesus teach? Jesus taught through parables. Jesus was not a theologian. Jesus did not give complicated concepts and complicated terms. He told stories that anybody could understand because he wanted to reach everybody and make them understand a message. And so he told stories. So again, we find in the New Testament as well that many of these works in the New Testament are stories that are supposed to be understandable by normal people and not academics, not theologians.
It's so interesting and fascinating that me, by reading what you translated, it connected to something that I had read. I made an immediate connection. And then you remind me, because I knew that, but I didn't think about it in that, from that perspective. It absolutely was oral tradition, pre-biblical times. Absolutely. So that makes perfect sense.
And what's interesting too is that for many centuries, the people in the Christian church in the Gaelic context of both Ireland and Scotland considered there to be this rivalry between the Christian church and the stories that people were telling in their homes, in their communities. And so this is another thing I pick up on in the book a little bit, and I discuss a little bit, but just that, ministers were very disapproving of a lot of these stories. And in, as a whole, both the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church felt that these stories were distracting people from their more important duty of being good Christians and learning the Bible and so on. And people were much more interested in these popular stories from Gaelic tradition than they were the stories from the Bible. It's only really since the Battle of Culloden that, secular society could be really dominated by Anglophones who were trying to get rid of the Gaelic language and get rid of the Gaelic culture and replace it with their own norms, that the church finally got enough power to try to to drive out these stories and to neglect them and to ridicule them and to put in their place the stories of the Bible. So that's the overall pattern. But what's also interesting and somewhat ironic is that most of the main people involved in recording these stories in the 19th and early 20th century were ministers and priests. The reason being that, you know, these are people that were themselves Gaels, but who were literate and who had empathy and sympathy for their fellow Gaels and wanted something of that tradition to carry on. And in fact, what's interesting is that the very beginnings of Gaelic literacy and literature emerge from almost the same context. You have people that are trained in literacy in Christian churches who are bringing this new idea of Christianity with them, but they don't want to obliterate everything that came before. So they start writing down, you know, the songs and the stories of their people, but in a way that is not in complete conflict consciously with Christianity.
For our listeners, basically what Michael does in the books, in the book, is he provides the classification of five types of fairy tale, of Gaelic fairy tale. And they are chapter one, tales of wonder, chapter two, tales about life in the world, chapter three, tales of culture, heroes and ancients. Culture, Heroes, and Ancients, Chapter 4, Historical Legends and Clan Sagas, and Chapter 5, Tales of the Otherworldly. And he explains how this is defined, he describes them, and then he presents samples or examples of the, each respective type of fairy tale.
Sorry, I just correct you by saying really folk tale. I'd call them folk tales. Yeah.
Folk tales. Sorry, folk tales. You write that there is no such concept of supernatural in Gaelic as there is in English. And I thought, that's a really, I was challenged by that statement. And I thought, how do I describe it? Something in English, my English language brain would describe that kind of stuff as supernatural. And yet you're saying it is not analogous. Their understanding of what we would call supernatural is not analogous in Gaelic. And so would it be correct to say that the Gaelic world didn't see entities that we would call supernatural as separate from their daily existence? So there was no separation between those.
Yeah, no, that's correct. And even, the way that we use English nowadays it's really absorbed ideas of modernity. So it's not so much just about language, but it's a way in which ideas about the world, about modernity, about cosmology have been thoroughly overturned and changed over the last 400 years. And so slowly but surely, these notions of modernity, about science, about what is natural and not natural, about the ways in which science posits the world, those things have been eventually, slowly, bit by bit, absorbed into English. But the Gaelic worldview, the Gaelic cosmology, like many others, I mean, people in South America will tell you the same kind of thing, it's taken a lot longer for those notions to come into the Gaelic mentality.
Would you say that those differences were common or were common among other ancient societies as well, as far as them not having that separation?
Well, it's modernity. It's Anglo-modernity that's has affected our world. And you could say it's European imperial modernity that invented this notion about, you know, science and the scientific worldview, which is a part of modernity, a core feature of modernity. That's a new thing. And it's taken a long time from that to start in the brains of, you know, the scientists of those empires in Europe for it to dissipate across the world with the dominance of European empires. If you were to go to England in, 500 years ago, you would find the same notion that there are these unusual beings, magical beings or something. I don't want to use the term supernatural because that's a modern term. These magical beings that coexist with people. So like that was a universal idea. It's just modernity has brought about this breakage in people's consciousness, in their cosmology.
I see. It's actually modernity that has changed our brains, basically, our outlook of looking at the world, the concepts that we have the last 500 years. And thus, it's not a Gaelic or an ancient Gael thing. It is an ancient or pre-modernity human thing.
Correct. And in the book, I try to represent how Gael see it. So they have their own particular cosmology, but this notion about, supernatural and natural, that is something that modernity brought that is doesn't exist universally.
And I know you say this in your book as well, that we cannot look at these societies with our 20th or 21st century brains. One of the biggest challenges when someone works with this type of literature, I mean, even comes down to the translation. Like there's certain words you obviously are not going to use because they would represent something. Whereas in one point in time, that may have been analogous. But if you use a certain term now, it means something completely different.
It certainly, yeah. I mean, the act of translation is really complicated because you're moving concepts from one language to another language. You're moving names and ideas, and you know they're two different worlds. So moving from the Gaelic world into the English world, you lose something in that process because I mean even the term fairy, like I said, the Gaelic understanding of the fairies is just totally different from what we in modern Anglophone world think of as fairies. So just all of the associations, all of the context, all of the meanings, usages of the fairies in Gaelic is just lost, you know, when you do that. And then there's, you know, there are beings in Gaelic tradition that have their own words and names in Gaelic that don't really have an equivalent in English, you know, like the Uruishs. So what do you do when you have a being like that? Do you translate that into something else? You use the Gaelic term, like it, you know, it's there's no easy answers because you're moving something to another world populated by Anglophone people who are not familiar with the Gaelic world, you know? And so you have to explain a lot that Gaels take for granted and because they have that background knowledge.
Would the Gaels have been animists?
I think that animism is kind of an informing principle in notions of, you know, the Gaelic cosmology that everything is alive. And in fact, the very first story, sorry, it's not the very first, it's like the third or fourth story, I think, in the chapter about the other world, where this Gael is out in the summer grazings and he hears all these voices amongst the plants, the grasses, you know, is a really good depiction of that animist worldview. And there's several other examples, but that is an example that's an example of the kind of thinking that informs the fairies, the depiction of the fairies in many ways, not in all ways, but in many ways, the fairies are a kind of embodiment, an animated principle of nature.
Animism interests me insofar as its relation or how it can inform or does inform the environmental movement in some ways, at least some people, or some societies, some especially indigenous societies. And anyway, it's fascinating. So I just had to ask because I know you're right. You did write that they believed everything was alive. And so I was curious if they believed everything was alive, would that make them, by definition, animist? Like maybe not pure animist, maybe a certain spice of animist, certain flavor of animist.
There's an element of animism for sure in the belief system. But again, these are terms and concepts that we use to analyze things and to generalize things that may not have translated to people in that way in their own brains. And, you know, that is one aspect, this kind of fairies as embodiment of nature. That's one aspect of the fairies, but the fairy lore is really big and complex because it was a way of using coded language to talk about a lot of different things, as well as an actual belief in real things and real beings. You know, so it's a way of talking about social norms. It's a way of talking about social tensions, a way of talking about what does it mean to be human, you know, a whole bunch of different things. It's not one thing.
You wrote about folktales in general, fairies being part of that. Folktales were a way to discuss things that would otherwise, put out there into for discussion, things that were otherwise maybe taboo to talk about someone. And also because these communities were so localized and you also mentioned very likely you were related to almost everyone in your community in some way. It was also a benefit to have these ways of kind of speaking about something, but doing so indirectly.
Yeah. And again, these are very closely knit interdependent societies, and just like many societies, even to the present day, there's going to be social norms and taboos that prevent you from being too sharp and in people's face when you want to complain about something or release and vent your feelings about something. So you need a coded way to do that. And songs and stories give you a kind of platform for doing that, but you still have to encode it in a way that is socially acceptable. It's not like Twitter and Facebook these days when everybody's, you know, ragging on everybody else.
Oh my goodness. Could you imagine if they had like a, I don't know, 12th century, 6th century version of social? I mean, I guess this was their social media of the day. Like,
That's what brought about the fall of the Roman Empire, obviously.
Yes. If people want to hear more from you, learn more about this and other things you've done, to give them a hint, what are some things that some things that you're working on currently, and things that you have planned?
Well, most of my efforts in the Gaelic realm these days are going toward Hidden Glen Folk School. So I have an online presence where I teach courses, and I also write blogs, and I've got a massive library of resources that I've created. So for those that are interested in accessing these scores of articles and essays, they can subscribe to the library. If you want to go into depth in certain topics, you can take courses. And I've got a certain number of blogs you can just read for free when you create a free account.
Oh, excellent. So where would it be? Would it be hiddenglen.com, or is it, we want to make sure people can get to you.
Yeah, I think it's hiddenglenfolk.org. I think that is the URL. I can send you the link afterwards. In the last, during the pandemic, I basically wrote 3 different books, and I can't,
oh,
I'm trying to recover
God.
Now. My life has to sort of go to a normal pattern again. So I wrote a kind of a general overview of Highland life, which is called the everyday life of the clans of the Scottish Highlands. That's kind of a general primer. Then I wrote a book about language called Gaelic in Your Gob, which explores 48 different words in English that came from Gaelic originally. And then I did this book, this collection of folk tales. So that's about as much as writing as I need to do for now. And, I'm teaching online and I have occasional talks here and there.
You spent the last few years, I won't say preparing for, but working a lot on books, on works that are aimed at making this field accessible.
Yeah, I think, one of the things that I've tried to focus on is these books that cover a lot of ground that provide normal people access to, rare resources and things that are otherwise, kind of obtuse and reserved and exclusive amongst, trained academics. So I've done a lot of that now. And like I said, the pandemic in a way was a good excuse to just hunker down and sit at the computer. But I've done enough of that and my life needs to recover.
We wish you as much recovery time as you need. And we hope that one day, maybe in a few years when you're recovered enough, have the mental space for it, that you'll reach out to us once you have your next plans or you're ready to publish your next work. We'd love to support you in any and all of those in the future. Yeah. So we wish you much rest, and thank you so much for joining us today, and also for sharing your about your website. And we know many Outlanders, Outlander fans. We know many people want to learn Scottish Gaelic, and if I understand correctly, that is something they could do through your site. Correct?
On the site, my courses are really kind of topics rather than language. There's a good number of people who teach the language, and I didn't want to step on their toes and go into their territory. So I teach courses, a general history course or introduction course about Scottish Highland life in general. Then I have a course called Reclaiming the Roots, which is kind of looking at Gaelic culture through the lenses of indigeneity. And then the next course is called Radicalizing the Roots, and that's looking at the intersections of the Gaelic world with empire, coloniality, and other aspects of modernity. Then I have a course about the diaspora, the Highland diaspora, in which I look at the history and literature produced by immigrants from the Highlands to North America and New Zealand and Australia. And then I have, finally, a course about Highland folktales.
It's actually even more accessible than a language lesson because you don't have to work to understand the content.
Yeah. I mean, in the courses I do, you know, we refer to terms in Gaelic and I explain how they come into play, like these terms that are not easily translated into English because they have specific connotations and are connected to Gaelic concepts and cosmology. Like, you know, we do spend time on that and unpack them. But the teaching is in the medium of English. But I try to make resources available to people who are Gaelic learners or Gaelic speakers who want to go into that kind of depth, but it's not required for the courses.
Well, that's awesome. So thank you so much for sharing that and for sharing your time with us. And we can't wait to speak with you once again once you've been able to recover more.
Tapalat gamor.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Again, a very special thanks to co-producer Rebecca. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.